Chapter 13. Snakes Alive. I hadn't returned to the New Guinea Highlands since the August school holidays of 1965. It was now May of 1966, and this time, I was on my way to Kundiawa in Simbu Province, located between Mount Hagen and Goroka. In the intervening 8 months, there had been a number of major changes in my life. I'd obtained a Queensland driver's license, completed Year 12 study at the Glenie Memorial School, and left Toowoomba without a backward glance, to focus on my immediate future in Sydney. My intention was to study art at the National Art School. I imagined my life in Sin City would be jam-packed with a myriad of exciting experiences, as well as an art training. This confluence of activities seemed a perfect fit for a self-confident, young woman like me, who was determined to give life a really good shake. I was fortunate to secure a place at the National Art School, and began my art training in early 1966. At the outset, I thoroughly enjoyed the freedom and buzz of city life, which was in marked contrast to the restrictions of the boarding school experience I had recently left behind. By the end of first term, I was yearning to reconnect with the wild grandeur of the New Guinea Highlands, and, to once again, breathe Kundiawa's clean, crisp mountain air that was in marked contrast to Sydney's air quality. To set the scene, Kundiawa was then a small eastern highland settlement, with a police station, a hospital, a post office, a bank, a fresh food market, a hotel, several trade stores and a small airstrip, one of a number in the mountainous eastern highlands. The town's European residents fell into two quite distinct camps. Those who worked for the administration, that is, government, and those engaged in private enterprise. My mother had been employed by the administration for almost 5 years before moving to Kundiawa. Her new job was huge. She had signed on to set up and manage the Wool Project, a Department of Trade and Industry initiative, to introduce spinning and weaving to the Highland people. As always, accommodation was part of the package. She was allocated a modern, airy, two-bedroom flat above Booker Stores, the most popular trade store in town. The building was situated alongside the airstrip. The flat's living room had the most splendid views out through a wall of glass with double glass doors that opened onto a narrow balcony. Irrespective of the time of day, the view across the airstrip to the rugged mountain ranges beyond was breathtakingly beautiful. In quieter moments, I loved to revisit the view. My mother had arrived in Kundiawa with all our possessions, including her precious car, a Karmann Ghia 1500S. Unfortunately, secure undercover parking wasn't provided as part of the rental deal, so she'd no choice but to park to one side of the Booker store's main entrance. One morning, not long after moving in, she discovered a deep scratch in the duco, running the full length of the car, on the driver's side. She was horrified, and instantly became incandescent with rage. Who would dare vandalize her precious car? With steam coming out of her ears, she immediately drove to the police station. After a time, she calmed down sufficiently to explain her predicament and ask for advice. The police officer on the desk was at a loss to know what to do. But another officer, wanting to be helpful, had a bright idea. He owned a large python named Charlie, and he kindly offered Charlie for security duty. As many of the locals were afraid of snakes, his suggestion was to place Charlie on the back shelf of the car, as a deterrent. My mother, who was at her wit's end, agreed to this madcap proposal. So Charlie was gently placed on the back shelf, after which my mother drove back to the flat, where she parked beside the Booker store's entrance, as usual, hoping that Charlie would do the trick. Time would tell. Once the shoppers caught sight of Charlie through the car's rear window, they were mesmerized. As both side windows were wound up, leaving only a small gap for air, they soon realized there was no danger, and as a result, more and more people crowded in close around the boot of the car to see him. After a time, the noonday heat became too much for Charlie, so he slowly slithered down across the back seat, and through the narrow gap between the front seats, in search of a cooler spot. Sometime later, my mother, keen to check the effectiveness of the recently installed reptile security service, came down to find a large crowd clustered in close around her car, hoping to catch a glimpse of Charlie. However, it became clear that Charlie was making matters worse rather than better, so after dispersing the crowd, my mother decided to return Charlie to the police station. But, where did he go? He'd found a cooler spot, under the dashboard on the driver's side, even though it was a bit of a squash for a fattish snake. And, it wasn't until my mother sat herself in the driver's seat that she noticed a thick loop of Charlie dangling down above the pedals. Terrified, she reversed out and drove back to the police station, very slowly, all the while fearful that the rough ride, caused by the uneven road surface, may disturb Charlie, prompting him to rearrange himself. If he did this, he could drop down onto her legs, thereby making it impossible to continue driving. Fortunately, the police station was only 3 minutes away. But extracting Charlie proved very difficult. He was extremely reluctant to leave his cool posse under the dashboard. His owner tried to soothe him, saying,
"Now, Charlie, it's time for you to come out."
And,
There, Charlie. Take it easy, fella."
But no amount of coaxing helped, so drastic action was needed. Finally, he was dragged out backwards, causing his scales to ruffle, and, as a result, he became very, very cross. My mother was so relieved to be rid of Charlie, and, I'm reliably informed, that this was the first and last time he was offered for security detail. True, I was on holidays, but my mother wasn't. The Wool Project headquarters and workshop were situated on the other side of the airstrip, and it was a given that I'd make myself useful whilst I was visiting. Having been raised around weavers and weaving, I knew the ropes. Each weekday morning, I drove the low-slung Karmann gear across the top of the grass airstrip and down the road leading to the Wool Project building. The building, known as the House Blanket, had been hastily erected on the grounds of the Simbu Junior Technical College in preparation for my mother's arrival. It was a large airy building made of bush materials with a concrete floor that had been built by the staff and students of the college. Kundiawa had been chosen as the Wool Project's base of operations because the success of this new enterprise was contingent on the support that the college staff and students would provide. In addition to building the House Blanket, they would use my father's drawings to construct the weaving looms and other equipment the Wool Project needed. I soon discovered that the weavers were both Ndugla and Kamaneku tribesmen, who had been hand-picked for this bold project. By the time I arrived, this new group of recruits were already fully trained production weavers, so for a change my role was social rather than practical. As I spoke the lingua franca, Tok Pisang, I had fun getting to know them better, because I knew full well it was possible to weave and chat at the same time. Some evenings, my mother and I would skip cooking and walk down to the only hotel in town, the Kundiawa Hilton, to have dinner with the licensee, Dick Kellart. Dick was a Dutchman who had made his way to the New Guinea Highlands from Indonesia. To our delight, he brought with him his vast knowledge of Indonesian food. He was a serious foodie, and as a result, the tucker at the Hilton was always unusual and delicious. But menu planning was often affected by the erratic delivery of provisions that were trucked up the Highlands Highway from the port of Leh. Heavy rain on the highway occasionally caused major landslips that could delay deliveries for days. Thankfully, the township had an abundant supply of fresh fruit and vegetables, grown by the local women, and sold at the Kundiawa market. One evening, we arrived at the Hilton to find Dick in a flap, because his English cook had suddenly taken off to New Zealand, pursuing a love interest. Out of the blue, he asked me if I'd take over running the kitchen. As an overconfident 17-year-old in search of challenging experiences, I accepted his request in a heartbeat, all the while knowing that I'd be guided by both Dick and his super well-trained kitchen staff. Because we ate at the hotel often, I knew that both the lunch and dinner menu comprised three courses: choice of soup, choice of up to 3 main courses, and choice of dessert, plus coffee. The kitchen had a large oil-fired Aga stove and an equally large propane gas one. The combined heat output of both stoves made the kitchen space very warm. Because of this, it was sometimes difficult to keep the serving staff looking crisp and cool, as they moved between the hot kitchen and the cooler dining room. Whilst working at the Kundiawa Hilton, an important phase of my limited musical education began. Stacked beside the record player in the dining room was an eclectic collection of LP records. In the pile, I found 2 records by an American group, The Byrds, titled Mr. Tambourine Man and Turn Turn Turn. For about a fortnight, I listened to both LPs on high rotation as we prepped for lunch and dinner, 7 days a week. Thankfully, whilst I was holding the fort, Dick managed to find a permanent replacement cook, and my job was done. In summary, the August holidays of 1966 dished up the unexpected. Exposure to snakes, hotel catering, and imported contemporary music were all broadening experiences for me. But all too soon it was time to return to Sydney to continue my art studies. I farewelled my mother and my new friends, knowing full well that I'd be back in 3 months for the August holidays. On reflection, the Glenny Memorial School, Toowoomba. My time at boarding school was an unpleasant experience, in a cold and loveless environment. As a direct result of those 2 unhappy years, I vowed I'd never ever return to Toowoomba. In 1983, I did return for a year, and again in 1987, and I've lived here ever since. This city suits me, because as I've gotten older, my needs have changed. Here, I'm safe in my bed at night, a major consideration for a single woman. In addition, this community supports me in a myriad of practical ways. This support has enabled me to continue making cutting-edge artwork for all the years I've lived here. Art studies. My mother, variously known as Ethel Vera Wyon and Gretchen Granger, belongs to a dynasty of British artists and engravers. After completing her secondary education in England, she went on to art school, where she acquired skills she put to good use ever after, in both her private and professional life. As I grew up, it was obvious that I too had creative leanings. Fortunately, my mother nurtured my creativity, in the hope that I'd follow in her famous family's footsteps, by pursuing a career in the arts. But my father had other ideas. He secretly harbored dreams of a successful career in medicine for me. In my teens, I came to know that a medical career was his unfulfilled aspiration, instead of the career path he was encouraged to follow, that of electrical engineering. Luckily, my underwhelming academic performance made medical studies a bridge too far. My mother's Type 34 Karmann Gear 1500S. In hindsight, my mother's relationship with her Karmann Gear was most interesting. When my parents' marriage broke up, my father took the good car, a 1950s black Mercedes-Benz. Ever after, my mother was determined to have a Mercedes-Benz of her own, and later she did. In between, she had an odd collection of second-hand vehicles, and then, roll of drums, the brand new Karmann Gear, which was purchased from the Volkswagen showroom, in either Leigh or Port Moresby. It was the only one in Papua or New Guinea, and my mother reveled in the exclusivity. To explain, one of the perks for expatriates living in Papua New Guinea at that time was the duty-free purchase of brand new motor vehicles. The only proviso was that the vehicle remained in Papua New Guinea for 2 years before export. Many expats took advantage of this perk, my mother included. The Karmann Gear was brought down to Australia twice before it was finally returned to Port Moresby to be traded in on a grey Mercedes-Benz 230 compact. After 2 years, the Benz was also shipped to Australia, where it was used to take us all over the country. Then, some weeks before we left Australia for Mexico, it was sold. Mexico? Well, that's another story. responsibility. I took on management of the Kundiawa Hotel kitchen without a second thought, believing in my ability to figure out what had to be done, and to do it. In my family, I had always been encouraged to have a go. Popular 1960s music. The Birds. Even though we found ourselves living in a small settlement in the remote New Guinea highlands, we weren't beyond the influence of cutting-edge music makers from other parts of the world. Facts. Kundiawa is the capital of Simbu Province. Sitting at 1,500 meters above sea level, it's surrounded by still higher mountain ranges. The area has an annual rainfall of 2,265 centimeters, with a daily temperature range of between 14 to 26 degrees centigrade. The province enjoys a perfect temperate climate, warm during the day and coolish at night. The Simbu people had first contact with Europeans in April 1933, when the Taylor Lay Patrol walked into their valley.